stands at 73%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, State Representative Corey Mason will offer his reflection of day one of the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, where he is a delegate. In part two of today's program, you'll be hearing from Laura Hermans, a young woman from Racine, who just completed a year's worth of work in Rwanda. Stay with us. And we are beginning today's morning show here on WGTD with Corey Mason, state representative for the 66th District of Racine, who is in Philadelphia. He is a delegate at the National Democratic Convention. And Corey Mason has very kindly agreed to slip into a busy schedule a few moments each day to offer his on-site reflection on the events at the Democratic Convention. And, of course, things have been off to quite an exciting and sometimes tumultuous start. So we're especially excited that we have this opportunity to connect with Corey Mason to get his perspective on what is unfolding in Philadelphia. Representative Mason, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being part of the morning show and for agreeing to do this. I do appreciate it. So, in a word, how would you characterize the start of this Democratic Convention?
Well, it was an exciting first day. It was really, you know, I mean, you know that you're part of an historic week out here in Philadelphia. We're going to nominate the woman who will become the first woman president of the United States. And there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of really strong feelings. There's Bernie supporters here who are sort of capping off the end of his campaign and expressing their love and devotion to him. But there's also, you know, a lot of excitement around what's coming this week and Hillary's ultimate nomination. There's a lot of people really excited to hear the speakers that we heard yesterday and the music we heard yesterday. And, you know, what started out as a bit of a tumultuous day, by the end of the day, you know, the few boos that were out there turned into cheers once Bernie gave his speech at the end of the day and insisted that, you know, we must elect Hillary Clinton to be the next president of the United States.
What was your reaction and the reaction of your fellow delegates, whoever you got to talk to, in terms of the controversy that was kind of a shadow over the start of these events, of course, namely the leak of private emails and an embarrassment, which ultimately led to the chairperson stepping down and in a sense also removing herself as a presence at this convention. How sort of disconcerting was that to you and any other delegates that you spoke to about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was not a good week for W. Wasserman Schultz. I mean, I think anybody being impartial about the events to say that this is probably not what she thought was going to happen when she got here this week. But, you know, I mean, look, I think it's really important, especially when there is a contentious primary, for people to feel like the party itself is going to be neutral and fair. And those emails made it appear and seemed to reinforce what many people had felt long before, is that, as David Axelrod said quite a while ago, it seems as though W. Wasserman Schultz had her thumb on the scale for Hillary from the get-go. And look, I've been a Hillary supporter from the start, but I think if we're going to be able to heal the party and bring everyone back together, you need to feel like the chair is impartial and that it was a fair contest. Now, I don't think anything she did changed the outcome of the race at all, but as we're trying to bring everybody back together, I think it was very wise for Debbie Wasserman Schultz to step down and let somebody else run the convention and really start a new chapter in terms of who the party leadership is. But that was just such a small, I mean, I know it wasn't that long ago because it was just yesterday at breakfast, but so much happened yesterday. It was, you know, by the time everybody was at the convention center in the afternoon, it had sort of been forgotten about as people moved on to the day's business.
One of the understandings I have from a couple of different reports is that, if we want to call them the Clinton people, those in effect in some leadership positions of the convention, were really thinking of allowing this first day to be a day for the Sanders supporters, and that, for instance, Clinton supporters should not be trying to outshout them or in any way sort of temper the expression of their frustration and so on, to allow them to have this moment.
Absolutely.
Was that your sense too, that's how things played out?
It wasn't like anybody was saying, hey, don't do that, or no, we can't do that. I mean, you know, it was a hotly contested primary, and the convention is about making sure everybody feels like they're heard and that we're all getting on the same team and moving in the same direction in November. So of course you want to have a day where Bernie can speak and you can validate and appreciate and affirm all the great work that Senator Sanders did and all the incredible work that his volunteers and delegates did there. And so, yeah, we had conversations early in the day on the convention floor about revising the superdelegate process because a lot of people felt like that was unfair. We had conversations about how things would move forward in the process to make sure that people felt that they were done more fairly. And that was a big part of what the Sanders people were saying yesterday. So there was space and time for them to be able to have that conversation. And then we moved on, and it was a great series of speeches throughout the course of the day. Cory Booker from New Jersey gave an amazing speech. Michelle Obama was incredible. He had Elizabeth Warren really give the speech right before Bernie Sanders came out. And it was really, again, for the few Bernie Sanders supporters who are here, and they're a minority of the Sanders supporters who are sort of saying, you know, we're not there yet. By the end of the day, most people were very, very excited about the platform that Bernie helped to put together, which is the most progressive, most pro-working family platform the Democratic Party's ever had, and his great speech to cap off the night at the end of the day.
I want to be sure that we talk about some of the non-politicians who are also on that speaker's podium, who were also a presence in this first day.
Yeah.
One moment that does not seem to be talked about a whole lot, but I think there was some significance to it, was the speech that was given by the Collins brothers, Jason and Jaron, both NBA players, and Jason openly gay. And tell our listeners what they had to say and what kind of impact you think their presentation had.
Well, I think it was very visceral and very personal and very real. And they talked about, you know, what their journey was like in the NBA and what it means to be, you know, the first openly gay player in the NBA and all those ramifications, but then unequivocal about how the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton specifically has been a place where they feel like they've got somebody who's fighting for them to make sure that they're treated fairly and appreciated, and it was a very powerful moment. It was a very powerful moment.
Another really intriguing moment was when Al Franken and Sarah Silverman were on that podium together, and it was also ultimately probably one of the dicier moments in which, in a sense, the tensions of the scenario were really revealed in kind of a different sort of way. Talk about that moment, and if you think ultimately what was said on that speaker's platform was helpful to the cause of moving everybody towards a little more sense of togetherness.
Yeah, I mean, this is the great thing about these conventions, right? I mean, not everybody here is a trained politician, and Sarah Silverman's you're a comedian, not a politician. But she gave an impassioned speech about how she is a huge Bernie supporter, was from the beginning, and that she believes in everything that Bernie stands for, and that's why she's going to work really, really hard to make sure that electing Hillary is what her priority is for the fall. And it was, I think, overblown in the press, but to her stage right, the California delegation has been particularly pro-Sanders and really wanting to sort of contest what the procedural changes have been. And so as she was giving the speech about going from Bernie to Hillary, as many speakers did yesterday, they started chanting Bernie, 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 and to the point where it was hard to hear what she was saying in the hall. And she looked over at the California delegation and said, "You're being ridiculous." And that sort of, it got people really riled up when she said that, because it was, I think, a sentiment that a lot of people in the hall were feeling, but also, for the people who had the "no, we're not letting go of this Bernie candidacy," it felt like they were being called out. So it was a tense moment, and then it was made a little bit awkward, a little bit longer, because they were sort of, Rankin and Silverman were sort of filling up some time while Paul Simon was getting ready to play his song, which ironically was, he sang "Bridge Over Troubled Water," and so it was actually one of the more dramatic events of the night. But by the end of the day, again, look, I mean, this is what conventions are for, so people can bring all their hopes and all their disappointments and all their excitement and all their enthusiasm, and it gives everybody a chance to really be heard and make sure that everyone's got a seat at the table. And so when you do that, it can get a little bit messy from time to time. It's not always perfectly scripted, as we saw with Sarah Silverman yesterday. But at the end of the day, shortly thereafter, within an hour after that, Bernie was on the stage saying, "We must elect Hillary Clinton president of the United States." And what few boos were out there on that sentiment suddenly turned to cheers as Bernie expressed in very clear terms what was at stake here.
By the way, Paul Simon's performance, as I was listening over the NPR broadcast of the convention, it was a little difficult to tell just what the sound in the hall was. Just how quiet and attentive was that crowd, or was he really singing over a lot of tumult? I'm just curious.
Oh, no. I mean, once he started, it was the cheers and the chants that, were going on. And even, because it's a long day. I mean, you're there from 2 in the afternoon until, almost, I think it was midnight by the time we get out of there. So people are moving around and talking to each other and networking. But once Paul Simon started, everybody just got much quieter and were paying attention to the stage. And it was really a very exciting time. And, they didn't pick that song by accident, right? It was a perfect way to sort of talk about, bridging both sides of the party,
right,
and moving us forward. So it was great. It's a little bit weird to hear that song without Art Garfunkel, but nonetheless, it was really, really amazing to see Paul Simon there. And it was a great event. It was a great time at an amazing day.
A favorite moment from any of the big major speeches that were given, that would be, of course, Cory Booker and First Lady Michelle Obama and Elizabeth Warren and finally Bernie Sanders. One favorite moment from those speeches?
Oh, I mean, I will say, it was really hard to pick amongst all of them. I mean, Cory Booker gave the best speech I've ever heard him give. I mean, it was really, really good. But, Michelle Obama's speech was just... when she said, and I'm paraphrasing what it was, but she talked about how she lives in a house, the White House, that was built by slaves. But now her daughters who live in that house live in a world where they don't even question whether or not a woman can be president. And that's because of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I mean, the whole place just sort of erupted when she said that. It just really, she just defined with such class and such clarity what was at stake for this fall. And so, it's no surprise that people were looking to her for for inspiration, given the quality of the speeches that she gives. It was really, really wonderful. Hmm.
So in our last minute, give us your sense of what is going to unfold today and tonight.
Yeah, today is, there's a bunch of caucuses and meetings and other things that'll happen before we get out there. There's no major sort of elected speakers or elected officials giving speeches today. Today is the actual historic moment where we will do the roll call votes and make Hillary Clinton the first woman nominated by a major political party and will no doubt become the next president of the United States. So the functional thing that the convention has to do in this week will happen today when we do the roll call vote state by state and count those pledged delegates and put Hillary over the top.
State Representative Corey Mason joining us via telephone from Philadelphia. He is a delegate at the National Democratic Convention. Representative Mason, we appreciate your time, and I hope we can do this again.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, I am delighted to be speaking with Laura Hermans, who is someone that many of you perhaps know, particularly if you live in Racine. Laura grew up in Racine, the daughter of Lynn Helmke and Reverend Walter Hermans. She graduated from Park High School, went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison with and graduated with a double major in political science and environmental studies, and more recently just completed a year's work in the nation of Rwanda. Rwanda, of course, is a nation in Africa that was very much in news headlines for the most tragic of reasons back in the mid-1990s when, of course, a horrific genocide took place there on a scale that still staggers the imagination. One of the most amazing things about the story of Rwanda is of its dramatic transformation. And Rwanda is now among the most beautiful and peaceful places on earth, at least to hear Laura Hermans describe it. And certainly that was her experience. And really seriously, Rwanda has addressed the sharp rift which helped spark this outbreak of terror back in the mid-1990s and has knit itself back together in some truly astounding ways. And I asked Laura Hermans to come on the morning show to talk about her experience in Rwanda. And by the way, her experiences there can also be probed further if you investigate her wonderfully written blog, which is called Peace on Our Wings. And if you go to peaceonourwings.wordpress.com, you can bring up all of the beautiful blog entries which Laura wrote during her year that she lived and worked in Rwanda. Laura Hermans, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. I think most people who know you were not particularly surprised that this was something that you wanted to do, to go work in a place like Rwanda, and you did so through an organization called Young Adults Global Mission. But I think people who know you would also say that this was a likely thing from quite a long time ago. Can you sort of sense in your mind at what point in your young life your interest in the wider world became this acute, and also your real burning interest in various social justice events? When did this really take hold of you?
Yeah, honestly, I have to give a lot of that credit to my parents, and in particular my dad. As a pastor, he was always working for social justice issues, both in Racine, and he was just very in tune with global issues as well. And I think as a child or an adolescent, it didn't have too much relevance to me growing up. But as I got older and started studying these things in school, I really started to have more of a connection with the things my dad was interested in and talking about and sharing. So I think he was really my key to looking at the world in a different way.
Hmm. So did anything in particular prompt you to seize this opportunity? You had, by this point in time, already graduated from UW-Madison, and I think you'd been working and earning a living and living a fun life as a young adult. I mean, are we talking about some aching void or some nagging concerns? Or I mean, just what was the motivation that prompted you to, in a sense, relinquish all that and embark on this kind of adventure?
Yeah, I think actually those words aching and nagging are actually kind of accurate. Yeah, so I was working in Milwaukee. I had always thought of this as an option, as a possibility. I had heard about the program back in college. The timing just never seemed right due to relationships. My father was sick at the time. So I never seriously considered it. But after working for a few years, I had this nagging and this aching and this feeling that there was something else that I needed to do and a different direction I needed to take. So I decided to listen and follow that to the Young Adults and Global Mission Program and was sent to Rwanda, which I'm grateful for every day.
Tell us about the process. First of all, when one applies to even be part of this, in general, what is this particular program looking for? What kind of people?
Yeah, I think the program is really not necessarily looking for even a certain skill set, but they're really looking for people that are open, to listening and open to learning. I think the problem with so many volunteer or service programs can be a mentality of going in to fix something. But what's different about this program is that they want you to learn. They want you to listen. They want you to meet people where they're at. So I think really the program is looking for young adults that are interested in doing that, which sometimes I think is harder. It's harder to go in with that mentality. So they're looking for young adults that are willing to ask those questions.
Did you think at the time very much about exploring something like the Peace Corps, which is a much better known organization, or did that just not seem like the right fit for you for whatever reason?
Absolutely, yeah. I definitely considered Peace Corps. Peace Corps typically does a 2-year term, and I think that was a little daunting to me at first, just being unsure of what international service might look like. So for me, the YAGAM program really offering a 1-year term was a little bit more accessible to kind of dip your toes in the water. So I decided to go with YAGAM, and just the philosophy of YAGAM, and the fact that there's a support system built in. So there were 4 other volunteers in Rwanda with me at the same time that I was able to lean on and ask questions and vent. So that was really became an integral part of the experience for me.
One of the things I remember is that you were offered an array of possibilities, and if I remember correctly, you could sort of register your own maybe top 3 preferences. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, we did a phone interview first and received an initial match. So my matches were Rwanda and Madagascar, and then we all of the young adults, there are about 90 of us, come together at a retreat, have a chance to interview with different countries, and then we are able to share our preferences. But it ultimately comes down to the program is trying to match people in the places they think you'll be the most effective. So we're able to give our preferences, and then we kind of trust the universe that we'll be sent where we're called.
So these workers don't necessarily do exactly the same work in all of these different places. I mean, different projects, maybe calling for different skills or different interests or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. So Rwanda had a big need for English teachers, but other volunteers worked in an arts and crafts cooperative in South Africa, or a college in Hungary. So different projects all over the world.
As you were thinking about doing this, how much did you think about the issue of safety and of going someplace where you were going to be safe? I mean, my recollection is that one of your preferred destinations, if it had worked out, was Jerusalem, right? And I remember your mom being less than ecstatic about the possibility of you being in, you know, I mean, Jerusalem's, of course, a beautiful city, but it's also sometimes in the headlines for all the wrong reasons in terms of some of the things that go on there. It just struck her as a dangerous place, maybe for you to be. Of course, danger finds just about everybody anywhere in the world. Did you think very much about that? And I wonder about even some of your colleagues also entering the program. Was that very much on your minds about, am I going someplace where I will be safe?
Yeah, I think that's always in the back of your mind, as something you're concerned about and want to keep in mind. But for me, just seeing the lack of control that you have in life, and seeing how things can happen to you no matter where you are in the world. And I think a big part of me going on this this year of service was my father passing away, and also the sister of a good friend who was 26. She was diagnosed with leukemia and passed away in a very short amount of time. So I think some of those experiences really hit home for me and just showed how short life is, and that bad things can happen to you in the U.S. And in Rwanda or wherever you are in the world. So I think that the safety concern sort of took a back seat for me, that I sort of could trust that I would be okay. I trusted the program. And once I got to Rwanda, honestly, I've never felt unsafe. I would joke with some people that honestly some places in the U.S. made me feel more unsafe than being in Rwanda. So my safety was not a concern once I got there. And I think I decided that, you know, I wanted to live a full life, and sometimes that means taking some risks.
We're speaking with Laura Hermans, who just completed a year's work in Rwanda through a program called Young Adult Global Mission. When it came time to go off to Rwanda, did you know very much about Rwanda and sort of this dark chapter in its really very recent history? Did you know very much about that, and did that give you pause at all? I mean, in terms of what you were going to find there then?
Yeah, I think I definitely had a lot of questions about what Rwanda would look like today. During my undergraduate work, one of my favorite classes, believe it or not, was actually called The Comparative Study of Genocide. And we actually looked at genocide throughout history, and the patterns that can lead up to it. So I did know about Rwanda through that class, and didn't know much about it in its current state, but was really curious to just see how could this country be functioning at this early stage. It's only been about 22 years. So I was very curious to see just how people were living and, you know, was this still affecting their lives? So I knew a little bit, but was definitely curious to see what life was like today.
Right. And maybe we should talk about that for a moment, because when I heard you speak about your experience, it's one of the reasons I was really anxious to have you on the morning show, is because you came away with tremendous admiration and respect, maybe even awe, for the way in which the nation of Rwanda has managed to knit itself back together after being nearly torn apart by this terrible genocide back in 1994. Explain to our listeners some of the ways in which the nation of Rwanda has gone about this process of, in a sense, healing itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw this at work every day in Rwanda. And I think it really started with the conscious decision that the government and the people of Rwanda made to move forward. They love their country, and they want to see it back growing and developing. And so just seeing how they've made this decision that they want to move forward, and they recognized that in order to do that, they needed to do it together. They knew that they could not go back to the divisions of the past. So many of the ways they've done that can be seen through business cooperatives, farming cooperatives, drumming cooperatives, things that bring people from different groups together intentionally so that I think the goal really is to see each other's humanity, to see that despite the violence, despite the hatred of the past, if you can get to know someone, if you can build a relationship with them, you can learn to love them, or you can start to love them and go from there to get rid of the hate of the past and build your future.
So are we talking specifically about, because it was Hutus and Tutsi, and Hutus, I think, killing Tutsis, if I remember correctly. So in particular, are we talking about cooperatives in which Hutu and Tutsi are brought together to work together and cooperate in whatever ways?
Yeah, exactly. And, a lot of women actually have really taken the lead on some of these peace-building initiatives. So you might have a woman whose husband was a perpetrator who killed, and you might have a woman whose husband was killed. They might be neighbors. They might have been relatives. But they recognize the need for coming together. And I think that's really a unique role that women get to play. I think they through their children, they see the future that they want for their children, and so are very intentional about building peace, about forming these relationships so that they can create the country they want their children to take from them.
Tell us a little more about the nation of Rwanda. Sort of what it looks like. Does it look like what we sort of think of as a nation in Africa? And is it an affluent country or a poor country? How much variation do we see in it?
Yeah, I think the landscape was one of the most surprising things to me. I think sometimes we have this picture in our head that all of Africa is a savannah, sweeping savannah with lions roaming. Mm-hmm. but Rwanda is right on the equator, so there's a beautiful climate. In the place I lived, it was about 75 degrees and sunny all year round. And just rolling hills, endless green rolling hills. So it was always, you always had beautiful scenery around you. And I would say Rwanda is still a developing country. So, but I would say it's a quickly growing country as well. So you could have a wide range of living situations depending on where you are. So the capital city of Kigali, it really looks like what we might picture of any international city in the world. There's skyscrapers, there's movie theaters, there's supermarkets. But you could go out of Kigali, maybe a 20-minute drive, and you could find, subsistence farmers living maybe in mud houses. So there's really the whole scope. But I think that's what's important to know about Rwanda and other places in Africa is there's not one picture of it. I think sometimes we get caught in our one picture of what a place looks like. But Rwanda has, I like to say, 1,000 hills and 1,000 stories.
Nice. So explain what your work was in Rwanda, exactly where you worked. I think you were in the small city of Butare, which I think was a big college town, right?
Yes, exactly. So Butare is the second largest city in Rwanda and home to many of the country's universities. So it was home to the National University as well as the private school that I worked for called the Protestant Institute of Arts and Social Sciences. It was an ecumenical university that was home to colleges of theology, education, and development studies. So I was teaching English there, both in traditional classroom settings as well as working in small groups with students and working on other communications and marketing projects.
You were telling me before we went on the air that when it came to actually teaching English, you were not given, let's say, an excessive amount of preparation in terms of exactly how to do that. Just talk for a moment about kind of the challenge of doing that, of teaching English without really being all that much trained to do so.
Absolutely. Yeah, so as far as formal teaching training, I didn't have much experience in that realm, but I did have a background of communications, presenting, public speaking, so I think that definitely came in handy. But Rwanda is desperate for more teachers, so I think just simply being a native English speaker was a huge qualification. So the country back in 2009 switched their language of instruction from French to English without much warning. So so the country is sort of playing catch up now with students that are sort of caught in between French and English, that are they're losing their French because they're not using it anymore, but not quite all the way fluent in English yet. So So being a native English speaker was a definite advantage to the university, but also a challenge because you had students of varying degrees in your classrooms. So it was always difficult to gauge where should I start and where should I go from here. Luckily, I lived with another woman for about half the year who is a missionary with the Presbyterian Church, who is also an English teacher. So she also took me under her wing and really helped me get acclimated and learn some of those skills that were really useful in the classroom.
So on a typical day with this class of mixed expertise, what would you do? I mean, where would you start?
Yeah. So I think one of the first steps was to sort of identify the strongest students, identify the leaders, and really ask them and encourage them to help their peers, which they did amazingly. They were wonderful at helping each other through the classes. So leaning on those student leaders was essential. And then from there, it was just breaking into small groups and just getting students comfortable as much as you could, get comfortable with practice. And so my goal was to teach some grammar, but also just try to get them using some practical skills like writing and reading as much as I could as well.
After that first semester, which was more of a kind of a formal classroom thing, your duties shifted then. What did you do in the second half of your time in Rwanda?
Yeah, so the second half, I had a little bit more flexibility. So I was able to do some small group tutoring, both with some of the instructors and with some groups of students. I was able to do other things like lead an English Bible study with some of the theology students, which that was actually one of my favorite things to do. We had some really good conversations. And also work with some students who were preparing for the TOEFL exam, so the test of English as a foreign language. So I enjoyed doing some of those small group activities with them as well.
So what typically would you do for fun in Rwanda, and with whom would you do it?
Good question. So at first, I think I was so overwhelmed and busy that sometimes I would just come home and sleep or or just crash. But otherwise, I did a lot of reading. There was lots of time for that. And then slowly, as I was able to develop relationships with the students and other instructors, then I found that I was able to seek them out to get coffee or... There's a great culture of just visiting in Rwanda where you maybe don't have anything specific you need from a person, but you go to just be together. So that, I think, was a beautiful part of Rwanda and something I slowly – it was hard at first. Sometimes Americans don't like to invite ourselves to things. So I had to get used to that and just ask, say, hey, can I come over? And so once I got comfortable with that, then I found that I was able to take advantage of the visiting culture of Rwanda.
So what's it like to eat in Rwanda? What is their cuisine like?
Yeah, so a typical Rwandan cuisine is definitely starch heavy. So you'll have lots of carbs. So lots of potatoes, plantains, rice, as well as beans, and lots of fresh vegetables and fresh fruit. And I think coming back to the U.S. and tasting a banana here in the U.S. for the first time was rather disappointing. So I will absolutely miss the wonderful fresh fruit. And the avocados. We had an avocado tree in our backyard, and so we were able to just go and pick our own produce.
So do they have McDonald's in Butare?
No, no chain restaurants, but there actually was a Chinese restaurant in Butare that was a favorite hotspot.
Ah, interesting. And you were saying, I think I read this in your blog, that Butare, in a sense, was like Rwanda's Madison.
Yeah.
I mean, in part because there are all these campuses, but in what other ways did you feel some affinity with the city?
Yeah, I think just the energy, and I think that might be common to any college town. But when you have that many young people together in a place, you just feel kind of this excitement and sort of a hopeful feeling. So I really just enjoyed that. And because of all the colleges, you also had lots of visitors, so foreign lecturers, foreign administrators. So you got a little bit more diversity in the city than you might see in some of the smaller areas.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Laura Hermans, who just finished a year's work with Young Adults Global Mission in Rwanda. And she is talking with me today on The Morning Show about her experiences in Rwanda. You talked about a couple of things in your blog that I want to give you a chance to kind of expound upon. One of them actually comes at the in sort of a matter of grammar when you're talking about some of the things that you were teaching to your students, and the whole matter of conjunctions, that somehow as you were teaching some of these students about conjunctions, it got you thinking about conjunctions and their function and the way they help us, in a sense, see the world and see each other. What did you learn about conjunctions in Rwanda?
Absolutely. So, yes, teaching conjunctions can be very difficult. But what I found most interesting was the conjunction and how going to a new place can really make you, can kind of challenge your brain in a way, because you start seeing things go together that you wouldn't necessarily put together. And so when you start putting the conjunction and in there, I think it gives you the opportunity to see people and the world in a different way. It allows you to put two things together that maybe you wouldn't have expected. So our Kinyarwanda instructor, who tried to teach us the language, he loved country music, which was just surprising to me. So that's where you put in the word and. You know, he can be a Rwandan teacher and love country music. Mm. He can be, you said in some of the ways that the Rwandans were trying to build peace, putting the and, I think, allows you to see their humanity. So a person could be a genocide perpetrator and a loving father. So the and puts back the possibility, I think. The and lets you take away the single story or the single label of someone and give them that additional piece.
Yeah, and I think you're right when we're talking especially about somebody who is across some kind of divide from us, we often don't do that. It's like that's just too much trouble.
And
we resort to the simplistic labels. Tell us about tea time in Rwanda.
Yes, tea time ended up being one of my favorite things. I think Americans are very effective workers, but sometimes we work too hard. So that was a good lesson to take from Rwanda, is just taking the time to take a break. So usually around 10:30, you would get to have tea time. And it was also, besides taking a break, it was the time to connect with people. I think, especially in the U.S., we can become very isolated. We can stay sitting at our own desk all day, and not get to interact with people as much as we maybe should. So tea time was this wonderful time where you got to enjoy a cup of tea and come together with your coworkers. And that's where some of the great things happened, where you got to learn about someone's family or discuss gun politics in the United States or figure out how to get tickets to the soccer match. So it's really where you had the chance to get to know people on a personal level, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah. The program that you were part of, you already touched on the fact that they do not see you as going in to, in a sense, an inferior country as a superior being there to fix their problems. And I remember as you talked about it, one of the terms that you used was a company, which sort of rang my bells because as a piano player, I'm always accompanying other people. And so I think about that term a lot. And apparently that was a really important term as your work was described to you, I mean, framed, so for you to understand exactly what you were going to be doing. Explain the way in which this word, accompany, was important.
Absolutely. To me, you know, accompaniment really meant walking alongside someone. Even you could think of it as walking in their shoes. So I think it was a really useful term and tool to frame the year, like you said. It really allowed us to put ourselves or put myself second and really put the people of Rwanda, put the people in my community first, to listen first instead of jumping in with my ideas. One thing that I learned throughout the year is I had expectations and things that I thought would be great ideas coming into this year, projects or, you know, groups that could really help the students. But once I got there, I realized that the things that were most successful were the things that were not my ideas. The things that were most successful were things that the students and teachers brought up in conversation or asked me about. So to me, that was an example of accompaniment, of having to let go of my ideas and expectations and really listen first to what do they want, what do they need. And it really, it became a beautiful thing, too, because in Rwanda there is, as if you are leaving someone's house, the host will always walk you out the front door to the front gate, or even farther sometimes to put you on your way. And they would always say, "Let me accompany you." And I loved this this practice because it also put into perspective that accompaniment is two people walking together.
So they're accompanying you as much as you are them.
So it's both. It's both people accompanying each other. And so that was a valuable way to look at the year and a valuable lesson, I think, too.
You were also told early on that the experience of living in a different country would be an experience of living in liminal space. That's a term that's unfamiliar to me. Explain what that term liminal and liminal space means and how helpful that was to you.
Yeah, so liminal space is really referring to the in-between. So I like to think of it as a doorway. So maybe you've opened the door and you're standing in the doorway. You've left your past behind, but you're not quite through to the other side yet. So you're standing in between in the doorway. And that was a lot of this year, was standing in the doorway. Because even when you're living somewhere long term, you start to feel like in some ways you start to belong. But you also always know that this isn't your home. This isn't your country. So you almost the entire year is standing in this doorway of not being in the U.S., but still not quite. You're not a Rwandan. You're a foreigner in a different land. And it's uncomfortable in liminal space. It's confusing and awkward sometimes as you're trying to navigate being in between two places. But I think there's also gifts in that liminal space because it allows you to look sort of from the outside in both directions. So it put me in a way of being outside of the U.S. and being able to look back on my own culture with different eyes. While also being able to look at Rwanda through my perspectives of an American. So while it could be very uncomfortable trying to adjust to new cultures while still maintaining relationships in the U.S., it really allows you to have new perspectives, which I think is really an important experience.
Real quick, your mom visited you while you were in Rwanda. How important was that?
It was huge, and I don't think I even realized how important that was until I returned back to the U.S. But just being able to, now that I'm transitioning back to my life here, being able to tell stories to her or bring up someone's name or mention a place, and for her to be able to know what I'm talking about, it's very comforting. I find that I'm anxious to share with people now that I'm back in the U.S. And so to have someone that knows the people and knows the places that I was is really important.
And do you hope you'll get to go back to Rwanda someday?
Absolutely. I love it. And I miss the people there. I miss my friends already. And I would love to have a chance to go back and see them again.
Laura Hermans, who's just completed a year's work in Rwanda with Young Adults in Global Mission. Laura, thank you for being here and for sharing so eloquently about your experience in Rwanda. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. And we'll also hear from State Representative Corey Mason offering a dispatch, if you will, from the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. On Thursday, Larry Tye talking about his book about Robert F. Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. In the book, Mr. Tye explores some of the ways in which Robert Kennedy changed dramatically in terms of who he was and what was important to him from the early part of his career to those later years leading up to his assassination in 1968. And on Friday, as the convention finishes up, we'll be joined by Carthage political science professor Jeff